All right, today's show for November 4th, 2009. And I'm still blown away by the previous show and Che Greenwood's wonderful interview with Chip Taylor and his friend. How do you follow that? We're going to try. And it's one of the strengths, of course, of KVMR that you have such an incredible variety in programming. We'll begin with my commentary for today. The recent worldwide revelations that Afghanistan's president's brother is on the CIA payroll happened last Wednesday. One would, of course, logically make the assumption that Karzai himself would also be on the CIA payroll. As a result, the opposition candidate for president withdrew from the highly contested runoff elections, and Hillary Clinton spoke into the madness. "There can be a perfectly legal runoff election with only one candidate." Joe Stalin would have loved that. The Afghans, being more practical than Hillary, simply decided to call off the pseudo-election and just keep our puppet Karzai ensconced in his fortress in Kabul. It might help you understand why we like Karzai so much if you recall that he once was an important employee of the Unocal Oil Company. Hey, wasn't Unocal one of the big oil conglomerates who wanted to build a pipeline through Afghanistan? What a coincidence. Next item. I was ruminating over last week's show where Nevada County District Attorney Cliff Newell was our guest. My first thought was how fortunate we are that we have a DA who's willing to come on KVMR and explain his thinking and respond to listener questions. Nevada County's come a long way from the time, not so long ago, when the good old boys ran the county, elected who they wanted, and didn't give a damn what ordinary people, and especially KVMR listeners, thought. My second semi-cogent thought was around the common view that Proposition 215 is so vague as to be a nightmare for law enforcement, who are stuck with an interpreting as well as an enforcing a vague series of laws. That certainly complicates their job, as most bureaucrats only want clear rules they can enforce without expending much brain power. But it occurred to me that there's brilliance in this vagueness. Bottom line is that by its very vagueness, the interpretation and enforcement of Proposition 215 is left largely in the hands of local officials. The state, through Prop 215, establishes the basic parameters, but then it's left up to the DA and sheriff of each county to fine-tune it as to how it will be implemented through their guidelines. The citizens of each county can also have great impact, as Mendocino and I believe Humboldt County have, by directing how much of county funds should be spent on actual enforcement of cannabis laws. So ask yourself, whom would you rather have creating the laws and guidelines for Proposition 215 medical marijuana? Local elected officials responsible only to local voters? Or legislators in Sacramento who are largely influenced by corporate interests and seemingly uninterested in the common man? With that thought in mind, I've decided that the vagueness of Prop 215 was a stroke of genius. Next item. To those of you who listen to supposedly neutral NPR radio, have you noticed how heavily NPR is pushing the swine flu vaccine? Talk about infomercials. It seems like every day they interview yet another supposed expert, all of whom matter-of-factly tell us of the dangers of swine flu and how we can get vaccinated to prevent it. They breathlessly report swine flu statistics like their election results or sporting results. There's never a mention that not all experts believe swine flu is any more dangerous than the ordinary flu that comes around every year, and not a glimmer of a mention of the fact that many health professionals warn against the vaccine as being potentially more dangerous than the flu itself. National public radio, indeed. Next item. I'm sure this will surprise no one, but a Freedom of Information Act request has pried loose transcripts of an FBI interview with ex-VP Big Dick Cheney. It seems that Big Dick set an unofficial record for not being able to remember. He answered 72 questions with, I can't recall. This article is by Pete Yost, Associated Press. Federal prosecutor Patrick Fitzgerald famously declared in the Valerie Plame affair that, quote, "there is a cloud over the vice president," close quote. Last week's release of an FBI interview summary of Dick Cheney's answers in the criminal investigation underscores why Fitzgerald felt that way. On 72 occasions, according to the 28-page FBI summary, Cheney equivocated to the FBI during his lengthy May 2004 interview, saying he could not be certain in his answers to questions about matters large and small in the Plame controversy. My question: why are not all government officials required to take lie detector tests? Would this be the end of civilization as we know it? And would that not be a good thing? Next item. In Breckenridge, Colorado, 72% of voters in early returns voted to make up to 1 ounce of marijuana legal for adults over 21. The measure is largely symbolic. Pot possession is still against state law. But supporters say they wanted to send a message to local law enforcement to stop busting small-time pot smokers. Next item. BBC News just announced that a court in Italy has found guilty. I believe it was 23 CIA agents. They had found them guilty of kidnapping a Muslim cleric and sending him off for torture. Steve Baker and I agree it's time to invade Italy. And final item for today. I just want listeners to know that every week I have twice as many articles I consider important for you to hear as I have time to read them. And if I take a week off to interview a guest, as I have for the past 2 weeks, the articles just keep piling up. If you value the information you hear on this show, how about deluging the program committee with a request to extend this to a 2-hour show? Conversely, if you think this show is a waste of radio time and should be banished from the airwaves, tell them that too. It's your station. Tell them what you want. And it looks like we have a caller. Caller, you're live on KVMR. I guess not. All right. On to the show. What Obama is Up Against. It's by Russ Baker, published in truthout.org. The first anniversary of Barack Obama's historic election finds many of his supporters already grousing. Fair enough. Obama has been more vigorous in some areas than others. But one essential question goes unasked. How much can any president accomplish against the wishes of recalcitrant power centers within his own government? We Americans harbor a quaint belief that a new president takes charge of a government that eagerly awaits his next command. Like an orchestra conductor, or perhaps a football coach, he can inspire or bludgeon and get what he wants. But that's not how things work at the top, especially where national security is concerned. The Pentagon and the CIA are powerful and independent fiefdoms, characterized by entrenched agendas and constant intrigue. They're full of lifers who see an elected president largely as an annoyance and have ways of dealing with those who won't come to heel. Compound that with the Bush-Cheney administration's aggressive seeding of its staunch loyalists throughout the bureaucracy, and you have a pretty tough situation. Obama, then, has to contend not only with the big donors and corporate lobbies. His biggest problems reside right inside his, quote, team. The internal battles between American presidents and their national security establishments are not much reported. But if it's an invisible game, it's also a devious and even deadly one. Our civilian leaders end up mirroring the chronically nervous chiefs of state of the fragile democracies to our south. Those who do not kowtow to the spies and generals have a bumpy ride. FDR and Truman both faced insubordination. Dwight Eisenhower, who had served as chief of staff of the U.S. Army, left the White House warning darkly about the military-industrial complex. He, of all presidents, had reasons to know. John Kennedy was repeatedly countermanded and double-crossed by his own supposed subordinates. The Joint Chiefs baited him. Allen Dulles despised him, more so after JFK fired him over the Bay of Kings fiasco. And Henry Cabot Lodge, his ambassador to South Vietnam, deliberately undermined Kennedy's agenda. Kennedy called the trigger-happy generals mad and spoke angrily to aides of scattering the CIA to the wind. The evidence is growing that he suffered the consequences. In the 1950s, the late Colonel L. Fletcher Prouty, a high-ranking Pentagon official, was assigned by CIA Director Allen Dulles to help place Dulles' officers under military cover throughout the federal government. As a result, Dulles not only knew what was happening before the president did, but he had essentially infiltrated every corner of the president's domain. One Nixon-era Republican Party official told me that in the early 1970s, there were intelligence officers everywhere, including the White House. Nixon was unaware of the true background of many of his trusted aides, particularly those who helped drive him from office. Remember Alexander Butterfield, the so-called military liaison, who told Congress about the White House taping system? Years later, Butterfield admitted to CIA connections. In December 1971, Nixon learned of a military spy ring, the so-called Moore-Radford operation, that was piping White House documents back to the Joint Chiefs of Staff. The chiefs were wary of secret negotiations the President and Henry Kissinger were conducting with America's enemies, including North Korea, China, and the USSR, and decided to keep tabs on this intrusion upon their domain. Jimmy Carter came into office as revelations of CIA abuses made headlines. He tried to dismantle the agency's dirty tricks office, but wound up instead a victim of it and a one-term president. Those who avoided problems, Johnson, Reagan, Bush Sr. and Jr., were chief executives that made no problems for the Pentagon and intelligence chiefs. All embraced military and covert operations, expanded wars, or launched their own. The agile Bill Clinton was a special case. No babe in the woods, he focused on domestic gains and pretty much steered clear of the hornet's nest. My comment, if you look at Bill Clinton's foreign policy, it was exactly in line with the presidents preceding him. He didn't make any waves. Back to the article. As for the Bushes, their ascension represented a seizure of power by the national security state itself. Their family had profited from arms manufacturing for decades. The patriarch, Preston Bush, monitored U.S. assassination plots against foreign leaders as a senator, and records indicate that the elder George Bush had been a secret agency operative for decades before he became CIA director, and then, 12 years later, president. Obama seems to understand his narrow range of movement and to be carefully picking his fights. He retained many of Bush's top military brass and even Bush's defense secretary, Robert Gates, who himself had served as CIA director for Bush's father. He has trod very carefully with the spy agency and has declined to aggressively investigate Bush administration wrongdoing on torture and wiretapping. Obama's campaign rhetoric about disengaging from Iraq seems a long time ago, and the war in Afghanistan is taking on the hues of permanency. The old boys' network is very much in place, and it's hard to work, and it's hard at work to force Obama's hand. A la Vietnam. Witness the leaking of General Stanley McChrystal's supposed confidential report calling for escalation in Afghanistan. The leak was, not surprisingly, to the reliable Bob Woodward. That reporter was himself in naval intelligence shortly before he went to work at the Washington Post, where he soon built a career around leaks from the military and spy establishment. The White House was furious at the McChrystal release, but what could it do? Presidents come and go, and the security folks have ways to hasten the latter. Covert alliances and payments to corrupt foreign allies continue, making creative diplomacy more difficult. In late October came a front-page story that the brother of Afghan President Hamid Karzai, suspected of being a major figure in that country's opium trade, had been on the CIA's payroll for 8 years. Anyone who finds this shocking should go back and read about the CIA and the drug trade in Southeast Asia. Throughout its six-decade history, the CIA has resisted accountability, with even some of its own non-spook directors kept in the dark about the agency's most troubling activities. As for the public's elected representatives, Nancy Pelosi is the most recent in a long line of legislators to accuse the CIA of deliberately misleading congressional overseers. None of this is likely to change soon, and not without a huge fight. Half a century after Ike's famous admonition, conflict and intrigue remain the engine of our economy, and everyone from private equity firms to missile makers to car and truck manufacturers count on that to continue. The Homeland Security industry, the most recent head to grow on this hydra, is now seeking permanency. So Barack Obama is boxed in, but so are the American people, and so, really, is democracy. Bringing this inconvenient truth out in the open is the essential first step toward taking back control of our government and our future. For all the reasons laid out here, Obama will need help. He may, in the rote formulation, hold the most powerful office in the world. However, to the extent which he controls the government he heads is another matter. That was Russ Baker writing in truthout.org. I don't have much time, and there's a lot to read, so I'm just going to skip over this one. The U.S. is ranked 31st freest press in the world. At the top of the list was Iceland, Luxembourg, and Norway. These were the countries with no recorded censorship, threats, intimidations, or physical reprisals. Why is free press in the United States not on par with these European countries? Reporters Without Borders compiled the index by asking the 14 freedom of expression organizations that are its partners worldwide, its network of 130 correspondents, as well as journalists, researchers, jurists, and human rights activists, to answer 50 questions about press freedom in their countries. One of the most damning things against the United States was of the many arrests of journalists during the Republican and Democratic conventions. It's worth pointing out that the index measures press freedom violations such as harassment, censorship, the legal framework of the media, the independence of the public media, internet restrictions, and financial pressure. To really get the whole picture on the media in the United States, it helps to have some background information. For the most part, media spreads a lot of information and corporate propaganda. This is not at all surprising, considering that Time Warner, Disney, Murdoch's News Corporation, Bertelsmann of Germany, Viacom, which is formerly CBS, and General Electric's NBC are the top owners of the entire media industry, which includes everything you read and hear in newspapers, magazines, TV, and radio. Books, records, movies, videos, wire services, and photo agencies. In the last 15 years alone, your sources for news have shrunk dramatically. Whereas in 1983, 50 corporations ruled the U.S. news media, by 2004, this number had decreased to a minuscule 6 corporations. That's from 50 down to 6. As you might imagine, with just six corporations deciding what's worthy of news and what's not, you end up with sensationalized tragedies, celebrity features, and anything else that will capture people's attention and divert them from the real issues. There's virtually no competition in the media market today whatsoever, and this spells disaster for all types of news. Then they go on to talk about the internet as being one of the few sources left. And the article ends by reminding you that all truth goes through three phases. First, it's ridiculed. Second, it is violently opposed. Third, it's accepted as being self-evident. So if you want to get to the truth, you often have to keep an open mind, do more than a little bit of digging, and even then, take everything you read and hear with a grain of salt. So perhaps rabble-rousing should be more properly be called the grain of salt hour. Here's something you might want to be concerned about. Oh, before we get into this, let's remind listeners that it is 12:26 in the p.m. You're listening to KVMR FM, broadcasting out of Nevada City, California. Your host is Chamba Lane. The name of the show, Rabble Rousing. Senate bill would give President Obama authority to pull the plug on your internet. This is from Mercola.com. CNET News has obtained a summary of a proposal from Senators Jay Rockefeller, Democrat of West Virginia, and Olympia Stowe, Republican of Maine, that would create an Office of the National Cybersecurity Advisor, part of the Executive Office of the President. That office would receive the power to disconnect critical computer networks from the Internet if it believes they're at risk of a cyber attack. Rockefeller said at a hearing, referring to cybersecurity, "I regard this as a profoundly and deeply troubling problem to which we are not paying much attention." Senate Bill 773, the Cybersecurity Act of 2009, is causing a flurry of opposition from groups like Campaign for Liberty, which has sent out letters to their members appealing to them to take action against passage of this bill, stating, "If the Internet Takeover Bill passes, Barack Obama can silence his dissenters directly by ordering a shutdown of all America's access to the Internet. But that's not all. Even outside of periods of White House-declared emergency, this bill mandates that private sector networks only be managed by government-licensed cybersecurity professionals." Dr. Mercola's comments, If you're thinking this is just another one of those out-there conspiracy theories drummed up to discredit the president or any part of the current administration, think again. Senate Bill 773 is a very real and very alarming piece of legislation that's pending action right now. Like the recently introduced Food Safety Enforcement Act and the slightly older Patriot Act and Homeland Security Act, the Cybersecurity Act of 2009 was introduced under the guise of public safety, but in reality contains inclusions that could seriously impact and threaten your privacy and civil liberty. According to CNET News, the act, even in a revised form, would allow the president to declare a cybersecurity emergency relating to non-governmental computer networks and do what's necessary. Okay, let me skip through this. The Internet has rapidly become a very important media voice and force. No longer are we imprisoned in our insular caves and dependent on the major networks and newspapers for our news. People like you, your friends and relatives, are actually using social networking tools like Twitter and Facebook to bypass these outlets, and information is capable of spreading like wildfire. Is the government now getting nervous, realizing how little control they have over this? Are they now looking for ways to shut down your access and contributions to this free source of information and truth? As you may know, there are countries that do this as a matter of course, but here in the United States, we're supposed to be free. The Internet has really become one of the last bastions of independent, free-thinking news available around the world. So the writer is glad to see that this Cyberspace Security Act is drawing widespread and deserved criticism. So what he suggests at the end, what can you do to protect your freedoms to use and access the Internet? There are two major social network players, Facebook and Twitter, and I encourage you to join both. Then while you still can, use the power of the Internet to spread the news about Senate Bill 773. So it looks like something that you might want to be concerned with and alert your representatives. Next article, Vietnam, Iraq, and the Wires, by Sherwood Ross, SmirkingChimp.com. It is a sad and dangerous development when supposedly objective news media yield to national pressure to slant the news in favor of the government. This routinely happens in dictatorships at all times, but it can happen in democracies as well, particularly in time of war. It was no surprise that during the rape of Nanking, a correspondent for a Japanese daily paper wrote home giddily about a nauseating contest by two crazed officers to see which of them could be the first to behead 100 Chinese prisoners. During the Second World War, the Japanese press reflected government policy, and if the government was mad, so was the press. Later, when Britain entered the war, a BBC broadcaster named George Orwell lied through his teeth to conceal the systematic bombing of German civilians by the RAF. And he wasn't the only one. Many American conservatives today believe the liberal press slants the news. Liberals think the mainstream media is conservative. They single out the Washington Post and the New York Times to illustrate this bias. Yet it is not these two influential dailies that shape the news as much as the wire services. It is wire service copy, particularly that of the Associated Press and Reuters, that accounts for so much non-local news in the world press. And to most readers, their names stand for objectivity. The reports of these wires not only feed newspapers around the world, but also thousands of broadcast outlets. AP is said to serve some 5,000 radio and TV stations and around 1,700 newspapers, reaching more than 1 billion people daily. Reuters, now Thomson Reuters, operates out of 200 cities in 94 countries and competes strongly with AP. Much of what humanity sees and hears is prepared by wire service correspondents, whose names are almost never household words, and who presumably learned somewhere how to write an accurate, objective account of a news event. The role of the wire services takes on increasing importance, too, as financially strapped newspapers downsize house staff and purchase more wire copy. Wire services influence public opinion, not only by what they report, but also about what they chose not to report. If a wire service knew of a major scandal, say in Washington, and did not reveal it, the corruption could do much damage. Needed reforms would never be pressed. So it was disappointing to me to read what Pulitzer Prize winner Peter Arnett had to say in his autobiography, Live from the Battlefield, concerning the manner in which his employer, the AP, slanted the news during the Vietnam War, even if it didn't suppress it. That war, possibly, may have been ended earlier if the American public possessed all the facts. Countless American and Vietnamese lives might have been saved. We reporters were forced to examine battlefield reverses in terms of American and South Vietnamese inadequacies rather than the communist competence, Arnett writes. There were no limitations on our reporting on the courage or the transgressions of the American soldiers, and we could praise or ridicule the tactics of U.S. commanders as factors in the pursuit of victory. Yet it was understood that while we could be negative about the enemy, we would not dwell on his military virtues. Arnett adds, it would still have been professional suicide for us in the AP to suggest that the Viet Cong insurgents and Hanoi's regular forces were generally superbly trained, well motivated, and seemed to believe in their revolutionary cause. We were dissuaded by our editors from suggesting that the Vietnam conflict contained significant elements of a civil war, even though every Vietnamese knew the truth of that description. And the results of not telling the full story? Arnett puts it well. I understood the confusion of the American public over the course of the war. Their government was telling them that the communists were on the ropes and their boys would soon be coming home. Then came Tet. I was surprised myself by the vast scale of the offensive, but not by its tenacity and boldness. The skill, perseverance, and rise of the Viet Cong insurgents under the most difficult conditions was never properly acknowledged until the Tet Offensive, when their formidable capabilities could not be ignored. Thus it was only when the Tet Offensive penetrated the media curtain did the tragic mistake the U.S. made in entering Vietnam become widely apparent. Tet was a victory for the enemy that could not be concealed or slanted by any jingoistic media. By and large, though, if the press had not been doing its job in Vietnam, it would not have been the target of successive administration attempts to muzzle it. As Arnett writes, if we'd been as irresponsible as our critics suggested during that span of 13 years, then surely it would be obvious in hindsight. We survived the many investigations by the Kennedy, Johnson, and Nixon administrations, all of which endeavored to manage Vietnam reporting by disparaging the press, and were not unwilling to use both the FBI and the CIA to achieve their ends. So the media had to be doing something right. But if AP had allowed its reporters to tell the whole truth earlier, fully and frankly, the casualties and devastation might have been less epic. Let me interrupt to remind listeners that nothing's changed. Are we getting the truth out of Iraq and Vietnam? Are we being told that the insurgents are involved in a civil war and they're also fighting for their country? One might call, if one was on the other side, one would call them freedom fighters. Back to the article. Are the wire services slanting the news today? Because AP slanted coverage in 1965. Does that mean it has followed a like policy in Iraq? Has it succumbed to Bush administration pressure to act as a propaganda arm of government? How critical were the wire services of the Bush-Cheney-Rice-Powell lies about Iraq's weapons of mass destruction that led us to the war? How much space did they give to the anti-war critics? Walter Brosch, a professor of journalism at Bloomberg University, Pennsylvania, said the AP could have been stronger in questioning the Bush government, but he points out that almost no paper was questioning, including the New York Times and Washington Post. Brosch added, the problem is that the AP tends to be so lacking of freshness and insight, it writes for the masses and tries to go down the middle. By doing so, it also doesn't offend anyone. He criticized a culture amongst reporters that they don't question. Too much of he said, she said world. Too much observing but not understanding. Going down the middle, however, might be well construed as writing it straight. Depending on your viewpoint, AP can be a shill for or a remorseless critic of the U.S. government. Columnist Jules Crittenden of the Boston Herald asserts AP is an anti-American news agency that seeks to undercut a wartime president and American soldiers in the field. Note, I've never heard anybody accuse the Herald of being a great newspaper. On the other hand, the website MinutemanMediaOrg.org reports, a new study conducted at Sonoma State University shows widespread bias in AP news reports favoring U.S. government positions. Peter Phillips, a sociologist at Sonoma State University, California, and director of Project Censored, says, the American people absorb these biases from AP and make political decisions on skewed understandings. AP's 3,700 employees and some 240 news bureaus are churning out so much copy, one can probably make a selection of the reports and argue either as Crittenden or Phillips do. Crittenden's claim seems patently preposterous, but Phillips might be wide of the mark, too, depending on his evidence. Unquestionably, though, Arnett made a strong case against AP's bias during the Vietnam War. 70 years ago, Curtis MacDonald, the journalism dean of Northwestern University, published a textbook titled Interpretive Reporting that posited it wasn't enough to reporters to gather facts. It was incumbent upon them to explain to readers what those facts meant. A lot of journalists attempt to do precisely this, and it's not an easy trick to be both objective and interpretive, especially when the news sources lie frequently. The objectivity of wire services merits careful scrutiny, as so much of the country's future, as sociologist Phillips points out, will be shaped by what the wires tell us about the present. Surely, a wire service's first allegiance must be to the truth, not the nation-state. These days, it should be noted, multinationals routinely operate in their own interests, even when it involves trashing their country of origin. They move offshore to avoid taxes, they transfer jobs to foreign countries to take advantage of cheap labor, etc. Surely, a wire service whose primary obligation is to the truth can also transcend any nationalistic allegiance when it gathers and reports the news. The question, of course, that was Sherwood Ross writing in SmirkingChimp.com. The question is, of course, do the wire services do that? Okay, we've got a call. Caller, you're live on KVMR. Caller, you're live on KVMR.
Hello?
You're live on KVMR.
Yes, John, but I just wanted to remind your listeners who actually owns Reuters.
Oh.
And the Reuters was founded in the 1800s by the Rothschilds family, and then back about 20 years ago, they purchased Associated Press.
Reuters purchased Associated Press?
Yes.
So they're both owned by the same?
Yes.
The Rothschilds?
The Rothschilds.
Neat. Thanks.
Yep.
Thanks for that information.
And that's from Eustace Mullins and his book, Who Owns the TV Networks?
Thank you very much for that clarification.
Okay.
Yeah, that might explain why our news is the way it is. Okay. I've got a ton of articles from American Free Press and no time to read them, but this one is, I think, is worth reading. It's straight talk from Congressman Ron Paul. Ron Paul is going to go down in history as being a very unique American elected official. And, of course, he will never attain high public office precisely because of what he writes and what he thinks. Humiliating defeat, bankruptcy await U.S. in Afghanistan. There's been a lot of discussion and debate on the continuing war in Afghanistan. Lasting twice as long as World War II, and with no end in sight, the war in Afghanistan has been one of the longest conflicts in which our country has ever been involved. The situation has only gotten worse with recent escalations. The current debate is focused entirely on the question of troop levels. How many more troops should be sent over in order to pursue the war? The administration has already approved an additional 21,000 American servicemen and women to be deployed by November, which will increase our troop levels to 68,000. Will another 40,000 do the job? Or should we eventually build to the levels to 100,000 in addition to that? Why not 500,000, just to be safe? And how will public support be brought back around to supporting this war again when 58% are now against it? I get quite annoyed at this very narrow line of questioning. I have other questions. We overthrew the Taliban government in 2001 with less than 10,000 American troops. Why does it now seem that the more troops we need send, the worse things get? If the Soviets bankrupted themselves in Afghanistan with troop levels of 100,000 and were eventually forced to leave in a humiliating defeat, why are we determined to follow their example? Most importantly, what is there to be gained from all of this? We've invested billions of dollars and thousands of precious lives. For what? The truth is that it is no coincidence. The more troops we send in, the worse things get. Things are getting worse precisely because we're sending more troops and escalating the violence. We are hoping that good leadership wins out in Afghanistan, but the pool of potential honest leaders from which to draw have been fleeing the violence, leaving a tremendous power vacuum behind. War does not quell bad leaders, it creates them. And the more war we visit on this country, the more bad leaders we will inadvertently create. Another thing that war does is create anger with its indiscriminate violence and injustice. How many innocent civilians have been harmed from clumsy bombings and mistakes that end up costing lives? People die from simply being in the wrong place at the wrong time in a war zone, but the killers never face consequences. Imagine the resentment and anger survivors must feel when a family member is killed and nothing is done about it. When there's no other jobs available because all the businesses have fled, what else is there to do but join ranks with the resistance, where there's a paycheck and also an opportunity for revenge? This is no justification for our enemies over there, but we have to accept that when we push people, they will push back. The real question is why we're there at all. What do our efforts now have to do with the original authorization of the use of force? We're no longer dealing with anything or anyone involved in the attacks of 9/11. At this point, we're only strengthening the resolve and the ranks of our enemies. We have nothing left to win. We're only there to save face, and in the end, we'll not even be able to do that. Ron Paul, writing in the American Free Press. Okay, let's follow up on that with an article by my favorite blogster, Fred Reed. He's got a blog called Fred on Everything. Surprised by Disaster by Fred, son of Tzu. In Afghanistan, why, you might ask, is the world's hugest, expensivest, most begadgeted military unable to defeat a few thousand angry tribesmen armed with AKs and RPGs? Easy. Character. The men running the war are mentally the wrong ones to do it. Think about this for a moment. Suppose that your boss at the lab or law firm or newsroom demanded that, when he entered the room, you leapt spasmodically to your feet, stood rigidly erect with your feet at a 45-degree angle like a congenitally deformed duck, and stared straight ahead until he gave you permission to relax. You would think, correctly, that he was crazy as a bedbug. If he then required reporters to stand in a square so he could inspect their belt buckles, you would either figure he was a gay blade or call for a struggle buggy and some big orderlies. This weird posturing is not normal, nor are those it appeals to. Suppose you showed up for freshman orientation at Princeton, and your professors bellowed at the tops of their voices 3 inches from your face, "Your shoes ain't shine good, puke! Get down and give me 50! Push-ups, that is, which in the military doesn't mean the better sort of bra. You would decide that the loon had lost whatever mind he had ever had and call Domino's for a cheese pizza double Haladol. Should you be so unwary as to suggest the foregoing in print, the response will usually be that the military needs discipline. True, and so do newspapers. However, there's a distinction between discipline and ritualized lunacy. At every publication for which I've worked, the editor was clearly and absolutely in charge. Yet I could say, "Yeah, Wes, but if we do that, wouldn't thus and such bad thing happen?" His decision was law, but he was happy to hear from subordinates who might know something he didn't. Editors do not require a vaguely sadomasochistic submissiveness. This hoopla is not of use in combat. The Taliban seem to be doing rather well. Do you suppose their commanders check their beds to be sure that a quarter will bounce from their blankets? Now, what kind of kid wants to go for robot training at West Point or boat school at Annapolis? Statistically, these kids are bright, gregarious, motivated, which is a favorite military word, athletic, perhaps even Eagle Scouts. Psychologically, they want, perhaps need, under a regime of rigid conformity and obedience that would appear as absurd as it is if we were not accustomed seeing it amongst soldiers. That is, they're auto-selected not to think for themselves or question decisions from above. They're exactly what universities exist not to produce. The service academies reinforce these unfortunate characteristics. Their schooling consists of 4 years of learning what to think, not how to think. There are hours of running in formation. If I die on the Russian front, close order drill, manual of arms, inspection arms. Why? There's no military value in being able to shift your rifle from shoulder to shoulder crisply. Like the endless inspections of everything, all of this participation in the hive inculcates groupishness and a curious sense of safety and conformity. The effects are remarkable, and from a standpoint of civilization, undesirable. Large authoritarian organizations make easier the compartmentalization of morality. A colonel typically will be a good neighbor, civic-minded, responsible, unlikely to steal your silverware, kick your dog. If the Pentagon tells him to bomb a city he's never heard of and has no reason to bomb, killing people who pose no threat to him, he will. He feels no individual responsibility for atrocious behavior ordered from above. I was only following orders. The Nuremberg defense is the bedrock of military ethics, if they have any. Men trained in conformist obedience can work marvels. They just don't care whether the marvel is good or evil. If you need to handle some vast natural disaster, call on the military. They have the manpower, the aircraft, the medics, the cooperation to get things done now. They will stay on their feet for 48 hours without sleep. They take on the mission, another favorite military word, seriously. What they do not do particularly well is wage war. Why? Because they have in their minds a view of war that is partly that of offensive linemen. You close with the enemy and destroy him, and partly martial romanticism. They speak of duty, honor, country, bravery, fallen comrades, proving oneself. Military history is rife with silly pageantry, nobility of spirit, glorious charges, and impracticability. Having been trained to think rigidly, they do. Before Agincourt, there were things the French might profitably have learned about longbows, but didn't bother because chivalry didn't concern itself with peasants. It was the glory of the thing, not whether they were committing suicide. English generals killed 20,000 young Brits in one day at the Somme. They hadn't compared the ideas in their heads with then-current military reality, such as that infantry charges over long distances against mass machine guns, artillery, and barbed wire are not especially productive unless you manufacture embalming fluid. Authoritarian groupthink, love of ritual, romanticism, inattention, not a happy brew. Further, military service encourages an often catastrophic sense of masculine potency. Running in formation with 50 other men, left, right, left, right, left, right, or watching a fighter catapult shot from a carrier deck. The thrill is gonadal, appealing to something deep in the male psyche, a challenge flung at life. It is wonderful, but not a sound basis for judgment. A consequence is a tendency for militaries of the First World to gravely overestimate themselves and thus underestimate their enemies. This is why they usually expect wars to be far shorter and cheaper than they turn out to be. As recent examples, the French did not expect those slanty-eyed little zipper heads to win in Vietnam, nor did the Pentagon have any idea that the U.S. could possibly lose 60,000 dead and the war in that country. Iraq would be a cakewalk, and those louse-infected towelheads in Afghanistan had no hope against American swoosh kapows. The U.S. military, in particular, has a compulsory can-do attitude with slogans like, "The difficult we can do today, the impossible takes a bit longer." This substitution of morale for comprehension is regularly disastrous. Having no idea what they're getting into is almost doctrine amongst professional soldiers. A major does not become a colonel by saying, "General, the French didn't do all that well at Dien Bien Phu. Maybe we ought to, do something else. We could invade Vanuatu." America's problem is not that its generals prepare for the last war, but that they don't prepare for it and then fight it again exactly the same way. Fred Reed, writing in his blog, Fred on Everything. Okay, we're almost out of time. So, where do we go from here? You know what? I'm going to give you a song. How about that? Because I don't have a humorous article to end it, I left it somewhere.
Discussing things as they are said to be. Says one to the other, now listen, you two. There's a certain rumor that can't be true, that man descended our noble race. Why, the very idea is a big disgrace. No monkey ever deserted his wife.
Those of you who've been asking about that version is by the Fabulous Thunderbirds.